I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Place branding and the economic impact of innovation are two topics of continuing interest to urban leaders. Today's guest will tell us about the latest developments in both fields. Simon Anholt, one of the world's leading specialists in creating brand strategies for nations and cities, returns to give us the results of the new Anholt GMI City Brands Index. Stay with us to find out which cities came out on top and which ones fell to the bottom. Rob Atkinson has been tracking the new economy since its inception. Rob is the director of the Progressive Policy Institute's Technology and New Economy Project, and his new book uncovers the impact of innovation on economic cycles and why it calls for a new public policy response. We'll talk to Simon Anholt and Rob Atkinson today on Smart City. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Simon Anholt is regarded as one of the world's leading specialists in creating brand strategies for places, for countries, cities, and regions. He advises governments, ministries, civil services, and NGOs on the branding aspects of public diplomacy, economic development, public affairs, cultural relations, and trade, tourism, and export promotion. He's written numerous books, papers, and articles on the branding of places, including his latest publication, the Anholt GMI City Brands Index. Simon, you have brought the issue of place branding into sharp focus with your journal, your books, and now the Anholt GMI City Brand Index. Explain what the City Brand Index measures.
Well, it measures the brands of cities, and what we mean by that is pretty much the same idea that forms the basis of the Nation Brands Index. Cities, just like countries, just like regions, just like tiny villages, they all have a reputation. They're all perceived in a certain way by people near and far. And that reputation may be broadly true, up-to-date, accurate, and positive, or more likely it can be confused, out-of-date, prejudiced, and negative. And that reputation, that perception, has a direct and profound impact on the way people behave towards the city. So if it's a city with a great, positive, powerful reputation, it will act like a magnet, and it will attract investors and tourists and business visitors and talented immigrants and all the other kinds of things that cities need in order to prosper. And if it has a bad image and a bad reputation, it won't get any of those things, or it'll have to try twice as hard or pay twice as much to get any of that stuff. So the City Brands Index is all about trying to find out what the reputations of cities really are. I always like to quote J.P. Morgan, because he said the wisest thing ever, really, about branding, although I don't think he realized at the time he was talking about branding. He said, "A man always buys things." And you have to forgive him, he said a man, because this was 1937 and they hadn't invented women yet. He said, "A man always buys things for two reasons, a good reason and the real reason." And the way I see it is that brands are all about the real reason. Mm-hmm. It's the heart rather than the head. And there are a thousand surveys out there telling you which cities have the best investment climate, the best meteorological climate, the best underground system, or whatever it is. In other words, hundreds of surveys telling you about all the reasons why you should, but none of the reasons why people do. So there's a lot of stuff about what's in people's heads, but nothing about what's in their hearts, nothing about the brand. So that's why we decided to do it.
How do you get at what's in people's hearts, the real reason people think highly of one city versus another?
This is the art and the skill of testing for brand. You can't ask people too directly. If you say to people, "What do you think about Seattle or Wichita Falls or whatever?" they won't give you a straight answer because they don't think in those terms, and it's a very difficult question to answer. So we sneak up on them sideways in all kinds of devious ways and create all kinds of hypothetical situations and say things like, "If you had to move to this city tomorrow, how welcome do you think the people would make you feel?" And then that translates directly into a brand warmth quotient. The company that does the research here, GMI, who are based in Seattle, they have this extraordinary resource, which is a panel of over 5 million regular consumers in somewhere between 25 and 30 countries around the world. And that gives tremendous power to this research, because it means we are really looking at a snapshot of global opinion. And we can ask a simple question like that, and the response to it is really Mr. and Mrs. Average from Everywheresville.
And the city with the strongest brand is?
London.
Now, Simon, this sounds a little funny. You are from?
Not London.
Okay.
Well, I'm from the United Kingdom, which is often confused with London.
No.
I have these crazy conversations with people when I'm at meetings overseas, and they say, when are you going back to London? And I say, I'm not. And they say, well, I thought you said you were British.
Well, see, that suggests the strength of the brand, I suppose, of London.
You're absolutely right. And that is one of the things that comes out of it, that London as a brand performs very similarly to the UK, in fact, ever so slightly better. There are some other cities which perform even better than the country that they're situated in. Paris is a very good example of that. Paris comes a very close second to London in the City Brands Index. It's a true global mega brand as a city. It's associated with style, with quality of life, with joie de vivre, with wonderful tourism, wonderful food, wonderful hotels, wonderful everything. France, as a country in the Nations Brands Index, scores rather miserably. Now, there are all kinds of reasons for that, which, of course, one can talk about for days. But the fact of the matter is that cities, in some respects, are often stronger brands than the countries that they sit in. But I'm not going to let it go, your tacit accusation that London came first because I'm from the UK. Believe me, this is the opinion of 5 million people, none of whom are related to me in any way at all.
Well, tell me why London scored so high.
Because, like all of the other cities that came in the top 20, it does nothing wrong. Nobody can think of anything particularly bad to say about it. The very slightly negative things are all things which tend to increase its aspirational value as a brand, if you like. It's perceived to be rather expensive, and that increases the aspirational value of it. It's perceived to be a little bit frightening, very busy, very commercial, very buzzy, and that increases the value of the brand, and so on and so forth. But mainly, what's extraordinary about London is that right across all of the categories that we test for the cities, it performs well. Most of the other cities don't do that. They perform well on one or two or three different indices, but they're let down somewhere or other. New York, for example, performs well for business, for excitement, for importance, for buzziness, but it performs badly on security and cleanliness. London is the only one that performs well on just about every index. People just think it's wonderful. And it's also the city which people know or claim to know best. So familiarity doesn't breed contempt in this case.
It's interesting that you say being perceived as expensive adds to the aspirational quality of the, or value of the brand. We often hear that being expensive is a problem for cities. Sort that out for me.
Well, it depends who you're talking to and what the subject of the discussion is. Clearly, if you're talking to a potential investor in the city and the issue there is that the city is perceived to be expensive, then that's a problem and you have to get around it. Because there you're talking about expensive in the sense that this is not a desirable luxury accessory, this city. This is a place where they've got a rent office space and hire help and hire lawyers and all the rest of it. And if it's expensive, that's bad. When I say that expensive is sometimes good, I'm thinking more in terms of the consumer view of a city who might be a temporary visitor, somebody who's not going to go live there, but somebody who's just going to go visit. And in those cases, the fact that it's perceived as being slightly on the costly side simply reinforces the basic belief that this is a rather cool place with a great deal of self-respect, and it's expensive because it offers value. When you go lower down the list and you're looking at cities like Johannesburg or Moscow or Cairo, if those cities were perceived as being expensive, that would be fatal. Because if people are looking at visiting or relocating in a city like that, they are looking for and expecting a bargain. But if they're going to the top of the list, London, Paris, Rome, Amsterdam, Barcelona, New York, Toronto, the high price is, in a sense, a reinforcement of the qualities that they believe the city has.
You also said London is perceived as frightening.
Yeah, I'm exaggerating for effect to a degree. I don't think that anybody, any of our respondents, ever used the word frightening. But there is a sense of distance between the respondent and the city. These cities at the top of the index, they're not cities that people feel close up and intimate with. They feel that these are big, important places where the individual visitor or traveler or even investor feels a little bit small. They're aware of the fact that these are places of global importance and that therefore there's a sense of respect and a little bit of distance. And that's all to the good. It just increases the power of the brand.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particularly strong component for each of the top five cities? I'm curious, is there a theme that is woven throughout the cities that are at the top of your brand index?
Each one seems to, apart from London, which, as I mentioned, seems to score tremendously highly, more or less, on every count, most of the others, there's a quality of the brand which seems to be the thing that drives it. So in the case of Paris, as you would probably expect, it's not really anything very much to do with business or commerce or money or technology or industry. It's all to do with lifestyle. Well, I was going to say it's to do with food, but curiously enough, almost none of our respondents anywhere in the world spontaneously associate Paris with eating. What they do associate it with, though, is the other things that go next door to eating, like hotels, like weekend breaks, like quality of life, like luxury, and so forth. Rome is a little bit the same, but the great asset that Rome has and the thing that helps it to score so incredibly highly is actually the Vatican. And we're not just talking to Catholics here. The Pope and the Vatican City, even though technically speaking it's not part of Rome at all, it's not even part of Italy, it's a separate sovereign state, but we don't worry about details like that. In the popular mentality, this is the number one attraction of Rome. Not just a tourism attraction, but the reason it's famous and the reason it's respected and looked up to, because that's where the Pope lives and that's where the Vatican City is. And that's what makes Rome a global mega brand. Interestingly enough, most of the cities that do well, with very few exceptions, have also got some big visual images, some great landmarks, something or other that people have a picture of, a postcard in their mind, that makes that brand really salient and really important for them. And London, of course, has the Tower of London, it has Trafalgar Square, although, interestingly enough, 6% of our American respondents thought that Trafalgar Square was in China. A momentary confusion there with Tiananmen Square, I guess. It's forgivable. Hey, it's only a survey. I'm sure they're not. They've got their brain slightly in neutral when they're doing it. Mm-hmm. But Paris, it's the Eiffel Tower. And the Eiffel Tower is a monument of phenomenal brand power. It's just better known than almost any other object on the planet. It really is remarkable. It's associated with Paris just about 100%. Nobody gets that wrong. Even the Statue of Liberty, incidentally, is not universally known to be in New York, even by Americans.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Simon Anholt. He is one of the world's leading specialists in creating brand strategies for places, for countries, cities, and regions. Simon, tell me, you use a six-point method. You call it the city brand hexagon to evaluate city brands. What are the six components on that hexagon?
I apologize, because in true consultant style, I made them all start with the same letter. They all start with a P. And the problem with letter P is that everybody who's ever done a course in marketing thinks of the three P's.
Yes.
This has really got nothing to do with that. This was just the best letter. We did some preliminary research to find out what basically were the components of people's views of cities. And we found, generally speaking, that they came into these categories. There's a thing that we call the presence, which is about the international status and standing of the city generally. So there we're asking people, how famous is it? Are you well aware of this city and what it's all about? Have you been there? Is it the sort of place you think everybody knows about? Has the city made an important contribution to the world in culture, in science, the way cities are governed, or whatever, during the last 30 years? The presence of the city is its general importance, its status. Then we go on to the one that I call the place, which is the physical place itself. What do you believe about what it's like to actually be in this place? Is it pleasant or unpleasant? Is it nice to be outdoors? Has it got a good climate? Is it easy to travel around the city? Is it beautiful to look at? And so forth. Is it nice to be there? Then we move on to the potential, which is the what's in it for me question. This is the one where we say to people, what are the opportunities like for you in this city? If you were going to move there, or even just go for a short visit, what opportunities would it offer you? Could you study there and get a good degree, and would it be worth more if you got a degree from that city or some other city? Is it a good place to do business in if you're thinking of investing there? And if you bring your family over, would it be good for them? Would it be a good opportunity for all of you? Okay. And then we move on to one that I call the pulse, which is self-explanatory. This is about the vibrant urban lifestyle, which is a pretty important component of a city brand. Is this a fun place to be? And are you likely to get bored if you're there for a weekend? And are you likely to get bored if you go live there for a year or 5 years or 10 years? So is there always stuff to do? Is there always stuff going on? Is it in the mainstream of the environment or not? And then we have the people. The people, of course, make the city. And we ask a lot of questions about the people. Do you think that they would be warm and friendly to you? Or are they going to be cold and prejudiced, maybe because you're a foreigner? If you're going to move to this city, do you imagine that you'd find it easy to find a community that you could fit into and which shares your language and culture? And would you feel safe there? And basically, those are the components. Oh, sorry, and then there's one I forgot, which this was my worst P of all. The only P I could think of, which really sums this one up, is the prerequisites. And the prerequisites are basically, they're the basics. They're the things like, does this city work? Has it got good infrastructure, good schools, affordable accommodation? Does the transportation system work and all the rest of it? The combination of those six facts, the city brand hexagon, is basically what makes the city a good brand or not.
Are there components that you left out that you would like to have included, but six was plenty and it didn't start with a P, or you couldn't quite figure out how to get at the issue?
No, we've been working on this model for getting on for 2 years before actually launching the survey. And just like the Nation Brands hexagon, I'm pretty certain that any aspect of the city that you could consider in one way or another is going to fit into one or other of those categories. You see, these aren't absolute questions. There are many questions under each of these points. They're just categories. I don't think there are any missing categories. It's going to be something to do with one of those six things. I'm willing, delighted, and happy to be proved wrong, but so far nothing has come up that seems to have been left out.
Do you value them equally, or is there one that's more predictive of the overall brand rating?
If there's one that's more predictive of the overall brand rating, that's probably the presence, which is, in a sense, the master question, because there we're asking people, do you think that this city has a powerful brand? We're almost asking that question straight. We don't, of course, use the word brand because it's not familiar vocabulary in this context to most people. But when we say to people, what do you think is the international status and standing of this city? Do you think it's made an important contribution? Do you think it's a major place? Then, of course, the ones that everybody agrees are important places are likely to be the ones that score highly in every other category. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, all of the other points of the hexagon, they have their own character and they have their own contribution to the brand. I mean, you can see how one like the pulse, which is all about the buzziness and the excitement, it's not fundamental if you're thinking of relocating your headquarters to this city, but it certainly plays an important role in the attraction and the desirability of the place. And even if you're the man or the woman who ultimately has to make the business decision about whether it makes economic and strategic sense to relocate to this city, the back of your mind, if you're any good at your job, you're going to be thinking about the staff who have to relocate there and the families that have to relocate with them. And so the buzziness, the pulse of the place to them is just as important as the economic potential, the infrastructure, the fiscal regime, and all the rest of it.
When you think about the range of cities that are included in the brand index, Mumbai, Cairo, Rio, Los Angeles, your survey participants would have to be pretty sophisticated to be equally familiar with those cities. So tell me, does familiarity tend to breed contempt, or does familiarity tend to leave a more favorable impression? And in other words, I've visited London, I haven't been to Mumbai, but I'm judging both of those cities.
Yeah.
Correct?
Correct. And, you know, remember J.P. Morgan again. What we're interested in measuring here is the real reason. What's in people's hearts? And if what's in people's hearts is formed from prejudice and hearsay rather than personal direct experience and real hard facts, then that's what we want to know. We want to know it just the same. Because even those prejudiced opinions formed on the basis of no knowledge and no experience, they're still terribly important. So if you're Lagos in Nigeria, which languishes, some would say unsurprisingly, at number 30 in the list, it's just as important to you to know what people in the world think about your city as it is for the people who have to run London. Now, there's a difference. The people who run London know that the perception is going to be probably a good deal closer to the reality. The people in Lagos know that the opinions people have of their city are probably going to be based on partial or total ignorance, but they're still just as much an important driver of people's opinions and their behavior. So we want to know what people's feelings are about these places, whether they're accurate feelings or not. That's immaterial. The important thing is, what do they feel and what do they think? And what we find is that people's impressions of the cities at the lower end of the index are, generally speaking, rather unfair. They make all kinds of assumptions about Lagos without knowing the first thing about it. I suspect that most of the people, we didn't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable by quizzing them, but I suspect that most of the people in our survey didn't know in which country Lagos lies. They know that it's in Africa. They make a lot of assumptions because Lagos suffers from what I call continent branding effect. In other words, there's only one brand out there, and it's called Africa. Mm-hmm. And thanks partly to the phenomenally powerful branding job done by people like Bob Geldof and Bono, who stand up on the TV every single day and hammer home what a catastrophe Brand Africa is. And it's a place where you could only give charity. And these are economies that don't work. Cities like Lagos and a lot of countries in Africa suffer as a direct consequence of that brand. Because if they're trying to get their economies going, which they all are, and they're trying to get investment and they're trying to get tourism, they have to fight against Brand Africa as created by the aid community. And they can't, because it's too strong a brand.
Well, if you were consulting with Lagos and at number 30, the last city on your brand index, where would you begin to help them improve their situation?
Well, I think the place I'd begin is the place I begin with every city administration or every national government I ever work for, which is to ask the toughest question first, which is to say, okay, here's your reputation, do you deserve it? And the answer, I have to say, Carol, 99 times out of 100 is, at some level, yes. You know, the brands of places are very seldom inventions. At some level, at some point in history, the reputation that most places have has derived from something real. And so the question you have to ask yourself is, if it's to some degree explainable, or even our fault, that we have this reputation, what can we do differently to change it? You and I have talked about branding places on many occasions in the past, and you know what my feeling is about this. You cannot change the image, the reputation of any place, whether it's a city or a country, through marketing. Because we've, all of us, that brand image that you and I have in our minds about New York or Hong Kong or Lagos, we spent 15, 20, 30, 40 years building up that prejudice in our mind. And we're not going to suddenly abandon it because we see an ad in the International Herald Tribune saying, hey, Lagos is a great place. It won't change our minds. So the question that Lagos has to ask itself is, what have we been doing that has helped or not changed the reputation that we've got? I'm full of quotations today. I think it was Einstein who said, the definition of stupidity is constantly repeating the same action in the belief that it will produce a different result. And what a great quotation that is. And this is what so many places, cities, countries, and regions all try to do. They think it's unfair that they've got the negative reputation they have, so they carry on doing the same things, and they carry on shouting just a little bit louder and saying, why don't you believe us? Why don't you know what a great city this is? Why don't we have a great reputation? And the fact of the matter is, they've got that reputation because they've been behaving in a certain way. And if you want to change your reputation, you have to start behaving differently. And that's why changing the brand is a matter of changing the policy. One has to take a brand-aware approach to policymaking and strategy and behavior and investment and especially innovation, doing new things to prove that you deserve a better reputation than the one you've got.
Simon, it is always a pleasure to have you on Smart City. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Carol.
Simon Anholt is the creator of the Anholt GMI City Brands Index. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Rob Atkinson about innovation in the American economy, and we'll talk to Otis White about life in cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, Los Angeles has a new mayor, and he is trying to bring some changes to the design and physical planning of that city that some are thinking are quite radical.
Yes. The new mayor's name is Antonio Villaraigosa, which is a tongue-twisting name, but he has a fairly unusual image in mind for Los Angeles. Now, I don't know what you think of when you think of Los Angeles. I think of sprawl. I think of low-scale development. I think of lots and lots of traffic. And I think of Hollywood. And Villaraigosa has thought this thing through, and he has decided that Los Angeles is headed to a completely different place. One of the things we've learned about Los Angeles is that it, in fact, is becoming a far denser place, meaning that there are more people per square mile there. There are a whole lot of reasons for that. Mayor Villaraigosa says, don't fear that, embrace it. He really thinks that Los Angeles is going to literally grow up, as in adding more stories, and that people are going to get used to living in condos and tall buildings, just like they do in New York and San Francisco and Chicago. And then it's going to be fine, and people are really going to like it there. And he also believes that Angelenos are going to learn how to love transit. He has been very, very big on getting more transit that will do something about managing the terrible traffic in Los Angeles. The other thing that Villaraigosa has done that I think is really interesting is he's dealt with what has been perceived as a liability for Los Angeles, the incredible diversity there. This is diversity on a scale. I mean, we talk about diversity. We have no idea the kind of diversity they have in Los Angeles, where there are 120 languages that are spoken commonly in LA today, many of them Asian languages. He thinks that Los Angeles will increasingly become what he calls the Venice of the 21st century, a trading center that will unite the factories of Asia with the markets of Latin America, that all that traffic, all the shipping and so on will come through Los Angeles, things will be added to it, and then it will be shipped down to Latin America. And it's the languages and the diversity that he believes will be the bridge between those two continents. He sees Los Angeles as perfectly positioned because of its hyper-diversity, which I think is an interesting image.
It is. He's a very persuasive, charming, compelling guy. And I think he brings a personal charisma to his ideas. And so if he can just do a few things right and buy some confidence of the people of Los Angeles and keep the finances straight, I think he can make some good headway. So I'm going to look forward to see what he's able to do in Los Angeles.
Well, let's keep an eye on him.
Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rob Atkinson is Vice President of the Progressive Policy Institute and Director of its Technology and New Economy Project. He is the author of the New Economy Index series, which looks at the impact of the new economy on the U.S. state and metropolitan economies, and he is also author of the book, The Past and Future of America's Economy, Long Waves of Innovation That Power Cycles of Growth. Previously, Dr. Atkinson served as executive director of the Rhode Island Economic Policy Council and project director at the former Congressional Office of Technology Assessment. You've been studying the new economy for a very long time, since its inception. How do you define the new economy, Rob?
Well, I'll tell you the way I don't define it, which is, I think, unfortunately, a way too many people define it, which is that it's something to do with Silicon Valley or with the Internet. And that really is such a misleading view of it. The new economy is really a much more fundamental set of changes that the U.S. economy has gone through in the last decade or so to become a much more global economy, a much more knowledge-driven economy, a more innovative and dynamic economy, and certainly a more technology-driven economy. There's no question that information technology is at the center of all of this, but it's certainly not the only part of it.
Did the whole Silicon Valley association, was it simply distracting?
Yeah, I think it was. I still get frustrated when I hear people say, oh, that's a new economy company or a new economy industry, as if these forces aren't affecting a textile company in South Carolina or an insurance company in Chicago. These transformational forces are affecting all industries, all regions, all types of institutions. So it's not simply something we can put over here in the corner and say, oh, yeah, that's just going on in Silicon Valley.
And so as you think about the new economy and its usefulness as a term, as a way to think about what's going on, in your mind, it's not a piece of the economy. It's these five sectors. Instead, it, as you say, are these fundamental transformational forces that are affecting all of us.
Yeah, exactly. I've traveled around some places giving talks on this, and sometimes people beforehand, they'll say, well, yes, we have some new economy industries in our region or some new economy firms. And I say, well, I hope all of your firms are new economy firms, because if they're not, you're in trouble. So again, it's not really whether what kinds of sectors or industries are there. It's really about, are all the industries and firms and institutions, governmental institutions, nonprofit institutions, are they all acting and behaving in line with this new reality that we have, which is that innovation is more important, constant learning, constant change, use and adoption of information technologies, being and thinking globally. Now, these are all the big forces today, customization and dynamism, speed. These are new forces. These are very different than where the economy was 40 years ago when my father was working. And I think if we ignore them or minimize them, it's at our peril.
And how are they changing American industries?
Well, you know, a couple of ways. One, and frankly the most important, is this new economy has led to a tremendous productivity rebound. From, say, 1940 to 1975, sort of the last period when we had a new economy, if you will, this post-war economy was then called the new economy, we had very strong productivity growth, and it led to upward mobility for a lot of Americans. That all fell apart in the 1970s. From 75 to 1995, productivity fell by almost two-thirds, and wage growth fell. And it's really only since 1995 and the rebound of the new economy and the information technology revolution in particular that we've seen very strong productivity growth. In fact, in the last 3 years, we've seen unprecedented productivity growth. So while that's not enough to ensure prosperity, we can't have prosperity without strong productivity growth. So that's one, certainly a big area, and we're seeing that all over now, where before, things that used to be done by people now we're using software and technology, and it's just leading to all sorts of efficiencies and growth in the economy.
And how is it changing the American workforce, or more specifically, what is expected of the American workforce?
That's not a simple question, and I think it's changing the workforce really in several ways. One is, there does seem to be a sense that information technology is being used in many, many more jobs than just simply, say, computer jobs. Most workers now use information technology in one form or another. And that technology is requiring, certainly enabling, but also requiring jobs be structured in ways that break down the old, what economists used to call the Taylorist function. In other words, somebody just doing one little function and doing it over and over again all day. Jobs are becoming more complicated and in some ways more fulfilling because of that. People are doing many more things on the job than just simply one thing. That's the good news. The bad news is that the new economy seems to be producing a type of occupational structure in the U.S. where we're seeing a fairly strong growth of high-wage, knowledge-based jobs, people who have a college degree or more. But we're also seeing a fairly strong growth of jobs where you don't really need very many skills whatsoever. The biggest job categories in the U.S. in terms of growth have been jobs like cashiers or retail clerks, janitors, restaurant workers. So I think that's a very big challenge for the U.S. to face, where we had this very vibrant middle class in the old economy. We're at risk of seeing that middle class shrink and low-wage and high-wage jobs replacing them.
Can we take the fundamental transformational forces that you identify as part of this new economy, can we use those forces to improve productivity of the low-end service jobs so that people in those jobs can reasonably aspire to a middle-class existence?
Well, you hit the nail right on the head, because so far the debate over the proliferation of low-wage work in the U.S. has, to the extent that anybody cares about it, it's really been one of, well, we should do things like help them get more education. And while certainly that's got to play a role in it, it can't be enough. And the reason is exactly what you said. Right now, there are too many low-wage jobs that are just not productive enough because of they don't use enough technology or they're not organized the right way to simply afford to pay people the kinds of wages that Americans deserve to earn. And so a big part of this agenda or this solution has got to be finding ways to make sure that these jobs use more technology, frankly, that we automate some of those jobs. One job I always think about when I drive up the New Jersey Turnpike, if I go to New York, is toll taker jobs. Those are, frankly, not very pleasant, often not all that well-paid jobs. There's really no reason we need those jobs. We could certainly reduce many of them if we had everybody use automatic toll transponders in their cars. But if we replaced and thought about that and then tried to grow the economy overall, we'd replace those jobs with better jobs. So also things like, for example, the unions have been involved in many parts around the country in trying to help employers remake bad jobs or low-wage jobs. For example, the Hotel Workers Union in Las Vegas has a big program there to help train hotel workers to become more productive and take on more roles. Those are the kinds of things we need to do. We can't just simply say that more education is going to be enough.
And talk to me about the example of the Las Vegas hotel worker, or some other example you may have where the job is not put out of existence with technology, but rather it is made more productive and the worker who is in it can remain in it and yet again have the opportunity for higher wages. Where do you see that happening?
It's not happening anywhere near enough, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One reason is simply it's very easy now for U.S. companies to take what some economists call the low road or the low-wage path. They can either do it overseas when they're confronted with cost competition, or domestically they can do it because we haven't raised the minimum wage, and they can get by with paying very low wages. And therefore, low productivity is not a big a problem because they're paying low wages. So what we really need to do is we need to think about how do we give employers the incentives as well as the help and direction they need to be thinking about restructuring work around more of a high wage or high road path. This has been done in some cases in healthcare, for example, where workers have been given more skills, and at the same time the work has been reorganized in part using technology, but in other ways just reorganizing work to make it more challenging, more cross disciplines involved in functions, and therefore ideally more output, and workers can earn more money because of it.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Rob Atkinson. He is Vice President of the Progressive Policy Institute and Director of the Institute's Technology and New Economy Project. He's also the author of the new book, The Past and Future of America's Economy, Long Waves of Innovation that Power Cycles of Growth. I want to come back to this issue of low-wage jobs a minute, because I think it is so fundamental to making a strong America. You mentioned the example of healthcare workers and reorganizing the work there to make it at least more satisfying and I would hope of more value that would then earn higher pay. Rob, do we know enough about how to do this? Conceptually, we can see where we ought to go, but do we know enough about how to do it that, again, keeps the worker in the picture versus your toll taker example of crowding the worker out of the picture with technology?
I think the answer is we're going to have to do both. There are just going to be certain types of jobs that don't pay very much. They're relatively routine. Some of those jobs right now are being offshored because they are so routine that low-skill people in other countries are doing them. Frankly, if we automated those jobs, we would get the benefits here. And then again, the issue is can we help train people so they can get new jobs? So part of it has to be that. The other part of it, though, is, as I said, has got to be about there's really, I should say, three parts. There's the automation part. There's the make work more valuable with higher skills and work reorganization. And we don't know enough about that. We need much better research done at the national level in those areas. We also need a system where our workforce, regional workforce boards, pay much more attention to this issue. And frankly, they have not. They have, by and large, just ignored this issue of saying, how can we use the workforce system and the money with it to help encourage employers to move in that direction? But the third thing we're going to have to do is, no matter how well or how successful we are in those first two steps, we're simply going to have to do a better job of making work pay for people in low-skill, low-value-added occupations. So things like raising the minimum wage, creating universal health care, better earned income tax credit. We won't be able to get there all the way through the market, so we need government public supports to play a role as well.
You mentioned the workforce boards, and it seems to me one of the things we do really abysmally in this country is workforce development. Once it gets outside the schools, and of course we're doing none too good a job there, but once it gets outside of schools, it seems to me that workforce development or training is not working very well in America. Do you see a better picture than I do?
No, what I see is a picture where we have some particular successes in particular places, but that we haven't built upon those to create a real national system. Now, I think if you look at a place like the UK, I'm very impressed with what they have done in the last few years. They have recognized that they have the same kinds of challenges that we in the United States face. And one of the things that the Blair government did there a few years ago is they created a new entity, a public-private entity, sort of a public corporation over in the UK, and it's called the Sectoral Skills Development Corporation. And they now have engaged employers that employ over 80% of the private sector workforce in the UK in these boards and engaged the unions in those. And what they do is they organize, they get employers and unions and educational institutions to think about particular sectors of the economy, whether it's metalworking and manufacturing or financial services or healthcare or media. That's what we need to do in this country, I would argue. In fact, in the book, I call for the creation of a national skills corporation, which would do that and would expand what we're doing now in the country, but work around these employer unions and educational institutions in a much more effective way.
Do you think there's political support for that?
Yes and no. Part of the problem now in Washington is that we spent a lot of time in the 90s with the Workforce Investment Act reorganization, and people aren't willing to yet, willing to say, maybe that didn't go as well as we thought. Maybe we should try a new or an additional approach. But I think that time is coming. I think the limitations of the WEA approach are being seen more and more. It's not to say that WEA is bad, but I think it has limitations that need to be addressed. And frankly, we've seen certainly some politicians, Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton from New York being the most visible, who have come out in favor of new approaches like a National Skills Corporation. So who knows? Maybe it would be an issue in the 2008 presidential campaign.
You've named at least one public policy response that you think is called forth with the changes that are wrought by the new economy. What other policies do you advocate in response to the changes that we're experiencing?
I think one of the things with the new economy is that each time we've gone through a new economy in the U.S., and I detail this in the book, that this isn't just something that just happened now. We actually have gone through these kinds of tectonic economic transformations about every 50 years or so. We did it back in the 1840s and the 1890s, and then the post-war period in the 40s and 50s. And now again, each time we went through those transformations, we reformed and restructured our economic policy in the country to reflect these new conditions. What worries me is that we're not doing that today. We still have an economic policy system that's really much more designed for the old economy, not for the new economy. And in particular, what we really need is an economic policy that puts innovation and knowledge at the center of it. Those are really the drivers of economic growth today, not simply accumulating more capital or making sure the business cycle is not too far out of whack, which are really old economy concerns that frankly still take up most of the attention and oxygen in Washington when it comes to the economy. But there are a number of people now who are talking more about a new economy or growth economics or innovation economics policy system. And again, I think that type of discussion is only going to grow. But I think we need to do that for two big reasons. One is the new economy is really powered by innovation, knowledge, and learning. We've got to have an economic system that supports that, an economic policy system that supports that. And the other reason that's so important now is for the first time in history, we are essentially facing a global economy. And we are seeing challenges from a whole wide array of other countries who want to go directly after the kinds of industries that have led us to prosper. And if we don't respond in kind, we're going to be losing out.
And economic policy that puts innovation and knowledge at the center looks like what?
I would argue, for example, that we need to reverse the decline in federal support for research and development. Really, since the 80s, we've been seeing a decline in federal support as a share of the economy. Many other countries have been increasing their support for research. And the decline has been in particular a problem in areas like the physical sciences and engineering. So we need to do that. We also, as I've argued in the book, we need to do much more about the workforce development system and education, as we've already discussed. But secondly, I would say in terms of our tax policy, we essentially have a tax policy in the last 5 years that's focused on tax cuts for individuals. I don't think that really makes much difference at the end of the day. It ends up, I don't think, incense anybody to do anything all that different. But we could think about a tax policy that tries to incent companies to do the kinds of things we know lead to growth. So, for example, we know that companies that invest in workforce skills and training are more productive than those that don't. We know that companies that invest in more equipment are. We know that companies that invest more in research and development are. So what I would think we need to do is restructure our tax system so that we have a training tax credit, for example, like some other countries do, that we have a more generous research and development tax credit like many other countries do. So we need to use our tax policy to basically encourage companies to invest in these building blocks for the new economy here in the U.S.
I know most of your thinking is done at the national level, Rob, but how about the local level? Is there anything that local governments can do to encourage the development of the new economy and encourage innovation, learning, and knowledge?
There certainly are. And in some ways, the bright spot from the policy perspective is that state and local governments have been doing this, and they've recognized this change, I would argue, much sooner than Washington has, and they've responded. Washington is only now getting around to thinking about what these realities are all about. And part of that is because state and local governments, they're not constrained by any sorts of ideologies that the market somehow is going to lead to the right results. They know very deep in their bones, a mayor or a governor or a city council person, that the market may work, but it may not work for their local jurisdiction. That to have their local jurisdiction prosper, they need to actually take steps to see that happen. And so that's why you've seen over the last decade things like local governments investing in research parks, for example, linked to universities, or establishing seed venture funds to help new entrepreneurs, or making sure that their workforce system targets the kinds of jobs that new emerging companies or companies that are expanding need. So there's certainly a lot of things that can be done. I think, though, one of the things that's very important is that in the old economy, essentially, people lived where they worked. In other words, the structure of our cities and our regions were really based upon where work was. And the new economy, it's shifting somewhat. So it's people are now having more choice. And companies are now moving or expanding to where knowledge workers are and to where skilled workers are. So cities now are no longer just the sources of production. They're the sources of where good skilled workers are. So if you're not a jurisdiction that has the kinds of infrastructure, amenities, government services, quality of life, a tax structure that is going to make you attractive to knowledge workers, it's going to be a lot harder. You can try to attract all the firms that you want, but if you can't have the knowledge workers that go with it, it's going to be difficult. So that's why I think this new environment is a little different historically in terms of what cities and regions have to do to prosper in it.
Rob, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Carol, my pleasure. Thank you.
Rob Atkinson is author of The Past and Future of America's Economies, Long Waves of Innovation That Power Cycles of Growth. CityView's commentator Walker Smith warns against passion turning into dysfunctionality.
I used to solve the New York Times crossword puzzle every day. Each morning, I would look forward to finding the puzzle and working my way through the clues. Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays were my favorites because those puzzles were hard enough to absorb me, yet not too hard to frustrate me. I always needed help on Saturdays, but I had the weekend, so I was happy to take my time. Whenever I missed the daily crossword because of vacations or travel, I would catch up upon my return. This meant doing a few puzzles a day, but I wasn't satisfied until I had caught up by working through each one in order. Then I could get back to my daily routine of solving that day's puzzle. Catching up with the New York Times crossword puzzles often turned into a real job, though, because some of my trips were pretty lengthy. But I was determined not to let a single puzzle go unsolved, so I would dutifully set out to catch up whatever it took. Keeping current was that important to me. One year, though, my commitment became too much to sustain. I was gone for a month on a Grand Canyon trip and then came home to work deadlines that required my full-time attention. The pile of unsolved puzzles got bigger each day because I couldn't keep up. I was so busy catching up with work that days would pass before I could tackle another puzzle or two. I couldn't enjoy the current day's puzzle because I was working on one from a few weeks prior. And the more I fell behind, the edgier I became about it. I started stealing away at odd moments and late nights to fill out a corner or stare at a half-finished answer. But that wasn't enough. It became clear that the only way for me to catch up was for crossword puzzles to take priority over everything else in my life. After weeks of worry, I awoke one morning to the realization that my passion for crosswords had become an obsession. And how stupid was that? Caught in the grip of a compulsion to continue my unbroken streak of never missing a New York Times crossword puzzle, even to the point of scrimping on time for other things in order to finish them. So I gave up the New York Times crossword cold turkey. I tossed out my stack of unsolved puzzles, and I quit trying to do one every day. Only occasionally, when I'm looking for a distraction, will I pick one up. Not that there's anything wrong with them. There's just something bad about how I handle them, which has become my new measure of temperance and suitability. We should be entrusted with nothing but what we can handle without diminishing or destroying ourselves. And if we're really honest about our capacities for discipline and control, that's a standard that would separate us from a lot of things we do, big and small. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for podcasts, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music provided by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.